Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting, fresh off an unofficial referendum challenging Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro's plan to rewrite the Constitution. The opposition has called for a national shutdown Thursday. More than 7 million voters, nearly a third of the electorate, turned out for Sunday's vote, aimed at pressuring Mr. Maduro to call off his own June 30 ballot. National Assembly Vice President Freddy Guevara appealed to the whole country to take part in a massive nonviolent protest, a civic strike as a mechanism of pressuring the government. While falling oil prices have contributed to Venezuela's economic problems, the opposition has also blamed the socialist policies of the Maduro government. Mark Jones is a regional analyst at Rice University.
It stands out over the last 50 years as one of the sharpest drops in standards of living in a country that hasn't experienced civil war or some type of other military conflict, where we've seen the standard of living drop dramatically. People are having a hard time getting access to food and basic health care.
In a statement Monday, President Donald Trump said Sunday's vote called a stand for democracy against a bad leader who dreams of becoming a dictator. Mr. Trump warned of strong and swift economic actions if Mr. Maduro goes ahead with his own vote. The Venezuelan leader has dismissed Sunday's vote as illegal and vowed to push ahead with the July 30 ballot as the only way to pull the country out of its current crisis. In Nigeria, at least 8 people were killed Monday when a female suicide bomber detonated explosives at a mosque in the northeast city of Maiduguri. Several others were wounded. 2 other female suicide bombers were killed in the city in separate incidents. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the Sunni insurgency Boko Haram is suspected. This is VOA News. A strong earthquake measuring 7.8 in magnitude struck Monday off the east coast of Russia in the Bering Sea, prompting a brief tsunami warning. There were no immediate reports of casualties or damage. The United Arab Emirates Monday denied hacking Qatar's state news agency. Anwar Gargash is the UAE foreign minister.
Of course not. And I think already our embassy in Washington has put these denials in place. And I think this is a crisis, and there's a lot of rumors and a lot of false news and stories, and this is going to die out. It's not true.
The Washington Post reported Sunday U.S. intelligence officials became aware last week the UAE orchestrated the hacking of Qatari government news and social media sites, posting quotes falsely attributed to Qatar's emir. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt have accused Qatar of supporting terrorism and gave Doha 13 demands after severing ties in early June. Doha rejects the demands, denies the accusation. Muslims appear to have heeded calls to avoid entering the Haram al-Sharif compound, known to Jews as the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, with protests outside over the decision by Israel to install medical detectors at entrances following last week's attack that killed 2 Israeli policemen. The compound was partially reopened to Muslim worshippers on Sunday. It includes the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. Mickey Rosenfeld, an Israeli police spokesman.
The Israeli police are continuing security measures in and around the area of the Temple Mount and the Old City in order to prevent any further incidents. The Temple Mount is open to visitors as of this morning, and security checks as well as the metal detectors are being implemented in the area to make sure that there are no suspicious individuals making their way inside the Temple Mount.
Late Monday, police dispersed hundreds of Palestinians blocking a nearby road and throwing rocks. U.S.-backed Kurdish and Arab rebels fought their way deeper into Islamic State-held Syrian city of Raqqa Monday. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the main fighting is concentrated around the southwest neighborhood of Yarmouk, as well as the central area near the old city. Turkey Monday extended the country's post-coup state of emergency in another 3 months, more than a year after dissident elements of the armed forces failed to overthrow the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Some 250 people died. The Russian Supreme Court Monday rejected an appeal to lift a nationwide ban on the religious group Jehovah's Witnesses. In April, the Russian Justice Ministry called for a halt to the group's activities, declaring it extremist. It allows the government to break up nearly 400 congregations and seize their property. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today's vice presidential debate in Kenya will go on as scheduled, but the two main coalitions say their candidates will not attend.
It is clear that one of these coalitions is going to produce the next president of the country as well as the deputy president, and therefore they are denying the public an opportunity to know exactly what the 5 years will look like.
Maurice Odhiambo is a leading member of Kenya's National Civil Society Congress. We'll look at elections and peace building in Africa. The UN Humanitarian Office in South Sudan says there was an increase in attacks against aid workers in June. And Cameroon gives an update of Sunday's tragic boat accident.
The most accurate information that I can give you right now is that there were as many as 39 people on board. For the time being, only 3 people have been rescued. 34 or more are unaccounted for.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's information minister. Conservationists call for enforcement to crack down on ivory gangs. And FM film director leads an effort to preserve African cinema. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Organizers say Kenya's vice presidential debate planned for today, Tuesday, will proceed as scheduled. This despite the fact that Vice President William Ruto of the ruling Jubilee Coalition and Kalonzo Musyoka of the main opposition National Super Alliance have said they will not participate. Two debates had been planned for today, the first from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. local time, and the second from 8 to 9:30 p.m. local time. Maurice Odhiambo is a leading member of Kenya's National Civil Society Congress, an umbrella group of civil society organizations. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the decision by the two leading coalition candidates to withdraw from the debate will deprive Kenyans the privilege to assess where the two main parties stand on some of the key issues affecting the country.
This is not coming to Kenyans as much of a surprise. I think what is surprising to many here is the fact that they can't reason out what reasons are making these main contenders not to take part in the debate. The presidential debates are just taking shape in this country. The first time that the debates were held was during the last election. And therefore, for many Kenyans, it's important that they listen to the leaders to expound some of their policies. Secondly, this are the two main coalitions. They have basically split the country into two in terms of support. So quite a good number of Kenyan voters would have wished, therefore, to engage with them, to listen to what they have to say. Thirdly, these two main coalitions are in serious competition, and therefore they have been making promises, and therefore it would have been a good opportunity for Kenyans to be able to question them.
Are they not depriving prospective Kenyans of the ability to choose among the two prominent coalitions that will lead the country come election time?
To a very great extent, yes. Again, there is no competition. I mean, all the other six or so presidential candidates are extremely fringe candidates and are really unlikely to raise even cumulatively 5% of the vote. So yes, it is clear that one of these coalitions is going to produce the next president of the country as well as the deputy president, and therefore they are denying the public an opportunity to know exactly what the 5 years will look like. And that's really the unfortunate bit in all this discussion right now.
Have these two main coalitions articulated the rationale behind their decision not to participate in these debates? Because I understand even incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta has refused to participate in the presidential debate, as well as Raila Odinga, who is the former prime minister and the main challenger.
They are not really saying why. I think the only thing that has come out is that they sort of don't see themselves in the same league as the other candidates, and they think that by being put together to debate, it's sort of a waste of time. It's like they're not going to measure up to the competition and in terms of marshalling votes and resources for the campaigns and so on. So it's not really a very convincing reason for pulling out and denying the public an opportunity to question them. For the current president, this would have been an opportunity also to just assure the public that there will be security during the election, because security is a national government executive function. There is a resurgence of terrorist attacks in areas of Coast Province, which again could have been one of the issues, I'm sure, on the table. Those who work in civic education are complaining about constricting civic space, and this could as well have been an opportunity for them to raise those questions with the potential head of state. So what they are left with is fringe candidates who basically are not going to be anywhere near State House, meaning, in fact, that the entire debate could collapse, because you're not going to spend your time listening to people who you know very well are not going to be anywhere near power. So really, that is the implication. And I think it's really unfortunate, because a lot of resources have been spent by the organizers, some of the media personalities behind this, and really, really, it makes no sense for the main candidate to pull out. But that is what they're saying, so ours is to wait and see.
Maurice Odhiambo is a leading member of Kenya's National Civil Society Congress. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotier from the capital, Nairobi. As countries like Kenya, Liberia, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo prepare to hold election this year, analysts in Washington are trying to identify key challenges to democratic elections in Africa and the ways of improving the electoral process. Viewers Maria Madialo reports.
Recent peaceful democratic transitions of power in Nigeria, Ghana, and Benin are considered examples for other African nations. Kenya will hold its general election in August and Liberia in October, but it's less likely the Democratic Republic of Congo will hold its planned elections this year. This week, the DRC's opposition group, Le Rassemblement, accused the country's Electoral Commission president of declaring war on the Congolese people by announcing that elections promised to be held by the end of this year probably will not take place. DRC's president Joseph Kabila was allowed to stay in power until late 2017 under a transition deal as long as elections were held by the end of this year. The U.S. insists that the agreement be fulfilled.
We are ready to take additional action to sanction those who stand in the way of the DRC's first democratic transition of power.
Last month in Pretoria, Kabila insisted his goal is to hold elections.
Let's organize elections together, as a nation, together as political parties, civil society. And we still have that objective in mind.
But more than just holding elections, Kabila has to go, according to a DRC social activist.
But the main problem actually for the DRC case is not having election this year, is getting the president to clearly say he's not gonna stay run again for the next term, because the agreement says they agreed he's not going to be a candidate, but he never said it clearly.
Elections should be viewed as part of the peace-building process, not as a goal in themselves, says democracy advocate Elizabeth Lewis. She says Africa has models to emulate.
I think Kenya is an example where kind of this look at broad-based constitutional and legal reform was a positive step.
As some countries face deadlocks and others' processes move along, a word of wisdom from a leading scholar.
We understand that elections do not by themselves a democracy make. However, they play a critical role. And free and fair elections play an essential role in sustaining democratic processes.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 18th. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Let's send shout out to these, our VOA affiliate stations, Radio Banga FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, Liberty FM in Juba, South Sudan, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda, and Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Cameroon's Minister of Information says Sunday's boat accident that killed more than 30 people will not deter the country from its war on Boko Haram and piracy. The boat, which belonged to Cameroon's elite military unit leading the fight against Boko Haram, was carrying as many as 39 people, according to Information Minister Issa Chiroma Bakari. He says, for the time being, only 3 people have been rescued and 34 or more are unaccounted for. Bakari says investigation is continuing into what might have caused the accident.
The most accurate information that I can give you right now is that there were as many as 39 people on board, and the ship was loaded with supply, food, drinking water, medicine, whatever people were in need of. So they were going there just to supply them when, unfortunately, the vessel capsized. And what is to be blamed on? For the time being, the investigation is being led by a team of experts to scrutinize in order to analyze all clues and evidence that could lead to the understanding of the reason why the vessel capsized. For the time being, only 3 people have been rescued. 34 or more, unfortunately, are unaccounted for. But if you want to know the reason, according to the experts, you have to be more patient until the thorough investigation, which is being led, is completed. And so soon as we get in touch with the result, you can call me in order to give them to you.
Is there a possibility of foul play, or was this just the result of bad weather?
Bad weather is more to be blamed, at least for the time being. But the investigation will leave no clue. All necessary measures, all indications will be given due consideration in terms of analysis in order to enable us to understand what exactly has caused this awesome drama.
Now, we understand that this boat belonged to the Rapid Intervention Brigade of your army that was specifically assigned to fight in Boko Haram. Do you think this might have an impact in terms of waging the war against Boko Haram?
Well, very much difficult to link missing of this vessel with the fight that we have been fighting against Boko Haram. And see, they are fighting piracy, not Boko Haram mainly, because Boko Haram is located within the country, in the common border with Nigeria. And it is difficult to imagine that they will be in possession of very sophisticated arms in order to endanger the vessel. Very difficult, but no path is a privilege. No one is left aside. The expert will continue the investigation, their investigation, and that their finding will be brought to your knowledge.
You said that this group was fighting also piracy. How prevalent is piracy off the coast of Cameroon?
Well, now that Cameroon and Nigeria and our friendly country are putting together their equipment and their armament and giving the commitment of our army and Nigeria army, very difficult to tell you exactly what is the frequencies of aggression and attack, because BIR, our Rapid Intervention Brigade, is very dreadful to them, and they are very much dreadful whenever they have to meet them. So As far as the piracy is concerned, it is very much difficult to underscore the gravity and the frequency of their presence there.
Mr. Minister, thank you very much again for speaking with us.
Merci beaucoup, Aiden, plaisir. Merci beaucoup, thank you.
It's Chiroma Mbakari, it's Cameroon's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Yaoundé. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan says there has been an increase in the number of violent incidents against aid workers and humanitarian assets. The agency says 46 cases were reported in June, up from 29 in May. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the details from Juba.
UN OCHA says the number of violent incidents against aid workers, lootings and break-ins at humanitarian compounds was up in June in South Sudan, but fortunately no aid workers had to be relocated during the months. In its monthly report released over the weekend, OCHA says it recorded nearly 50 incidents of violence against aid workers in June. Gemma Connell, Deputy Head of Office for UN OCHA in South Sudan, says at least 100 incidents were documented in June which negatively impacted humanitarian workers.
These are incidents that impact on the ability of humanitarian organizations to reach people in need. They vary in type from having difficulties with transferring cash at the airport through to violent attacks against aid workers or the introduction of new paperwork that slows down processes, interference in human resource processes. So there's a wide variety of types of incidents.
Connell says 24 humanitarian compounds, including offices, residences, and warehouses, were broken into across South Sudan in June, resulting in the looting of humanitarian supplies and theft of staff members' personal belongings. She says all aid workers want is for the warring parties to allow free, unhindered access to those in need of aid and to provide safety for all humanitarian workers.
One of the things that really concerned us in this respect in June was the number of incidents that involved violence against either aid workers or aid assets, so compounds, cars, etc. There were 46 incidents in June that involved violence against aid workers and assets, and that's incredibly alarming.
OCHA says 9 out of 14 community volunteers and health workers detained by armed forces in Unity's Gwit County early last month remain in detention. Humanitarian agencies continue to negotiate with authorities for their safe release. In June, OCHA recorded at least 20 incidents of robbery or ambush of humanitarian workers' vehicles that were either en route to deliver humanitarian assistance or were prepositioning food and other emergency items in remote areas. Connell says such incidents were common in the former Lakes, Western Equatoria, Eastern Equatoria, and Central Equatoria states. She says continuous acts of violence or threats of violence against aid workers curtails the delivery of life-saving assistance to the population affected by conflict.
It does have an impact on our work. It impacts on staff's willingness to go to certain locations and it impacts on managers' decisions that they take. What we're doing constantly, every single day, nearly every single hour, is to engage with the authorities everywhere to try and make sure that they give us the guarantees of safety and security. Now, when I say that, we don't expect one party to give us a safety and security guarantee for an area that's controlled by someone else. No. All that we expect is that for the area that you control, whichever authority you are, that you guarantee aid worker safety and security in that area.
On June 5th, Gemma says aid agencies were forced to suspend a planned food distribution to more than 7,500 vulnerable people in Pibor and Fertet in Jongole because of interference from government soldiers. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
American filmmaker Martin Scorsese is backing an international effort to preserve African movies, hoping to protect the work of some of Africa's most influential directors. Azuma Kampari reports.
Preserving the past for the future. That's the goal of the African Film Heritage Project, restoring some of Africa's most important and influential movies. Academy Award-winning director Martin Scorsese is among those sponsoring the effort.
The idea of the World Cinema Foundation was to restore and make available, as best as possible, films made in areas that really don't have the infrastructure. the archival infrastructure to take care of these films and take care of their cultural heritage.
Scorsese's Film Foundation is joining the Pan-African Federation of Filmmakers and UNESCO to safeguard the power of African culture.
We will not just give justice to the African history and creativity, but we will encourage also nowadays young people to continue to embark on new journeys through partnerships and to continue to create.
50 films were selected for restoration by African directors. Movies, Scorsese says, are a hidden part of the continent's history.
Those films were made by Africans, about Africans, for Africans, for the world. And it's time to take that as another facet of the culture, the creative thinking, the creative action of the entire continent.
Director Yemani Desimye teaches filmmaking at New York University.
Many African films that were made in the previous century don't have the opportunity to be screened by filmmakers all over the world, be they African, Australian, or Bolivian. And it is with such initiatives that these films become part of the vernacular, of the international vernacular.
Scorsese told VOA that young filmmakers everywhere would benefit from taking a longer look at African cinema.
I think it's something that could be very fruitful for young people who are beginning to make their own films or are making their own films.
In the past 10 years, Scorsese's World Cinema Project has helped restore films from Egypt and Senegal, as well as from India, Armenia, Brazil, and the Philippines. Arzuma Kampaure for VOA News, New York.
A year into the Senegalese government's new program to stop child begging, Human Rights Watch says official efforts are falling short. Tens of thousands of Talibi, as the Quranic school students are known, are forced to beg on the streets throughout Senegal to bring back money to their religious teachers. Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Jim Warmington talks to Ricky Stryak about how the program needs to improve to protect children's rights.
The first success is just that the program itself really reflects a priority being given by the Senegalese government and by Macky Sall himself to tackling the problem of child begging. And certainly Sall's personal commitment to stopping the problem and even to prosecuting and sanctioning those people who force children to beg is an extremely welcome development and reflects, I think, the increased attention that the problem of Talibé has got. Also amongst Senegalese society and Senegalese civil society. Also, it did have some concrete impact when the program was first implemented. There's been at least 1,500 children who've been picked off the streets of Dakar up until March 2017, and hundreds of those children have been returned to their parents.
After these children are returned to their families, how are we sure that they're not being sent right back to the Daras, basically?
Well, and that's, I think, a really, really good question. And certainly a key element of this is educating parents. And the Senegalese government, I think, has placed a focus on educating parents as to the fact that there are children, many, many children in Quranic schools who are forced to beg and who even suffer worst abuses, including physical abuse and sexual abuse. And so I think a big priority of the Senegalese government has been to try to educate parents to make sure that children are not being sent back to the Daras. But also, on the other hand, I think that the element that's been missing is regulating, first of all, Daras, putting them on a legal footing that means the government has oversight of what's actually happening inside of Quranic schools, the conditions, whether children are actually learning something or whether, for example, they are being forced to beg on the street.
Jim Warmington is a Human Rights Watch Africa researcher. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from New York City. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth discussion on African elections. What makes a ballot credible? Some political observers say African elections are often merely selections. We'll tackle the difference on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.